Hello, I'm Jim Falzerano. It's Wednesday, the 5th of August. In today's program, Lord Adonis says high-speed rail will help make Britain green, but will it cost too much?
The only way a high-speed rail network will go ahead is if it is a number one spending priority. What we're looking at is there won't be the money for a number one spending priority.
Barack Obama sends a Clinton to North Korea. But it's not Hillary.
None of the analysts you speak to really believe that the husband of the Secretary of State is going all the way to North Korea without the tacit approval, at least, of the White House.
And from Bauhaus to Bee House, how city dwellers can help save the honeybee.
Trying to bring the buzz back into urban environments.
But first, Bill Overton's got the headlines.
Opposition supporters have surrounded the Iranian parliament to protest at the inauguration ceremony of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. His disputed re-election split the country's establishment, with many senior clerics boycotting the event. At least 30 people died during demonstrations which followed the presidential election last month. Britain, Germany, France and the US have all said they'll not be sending letters of congratulation to the president. The Lloyds Banking Group's announced losses of £4 billion for the first half of this year. The part-nationalised bank had already warned investors it would make a loss, with most of the bad debts on its balance sheet inherited after the bank's rescue takeover of Halifax Bank of Scotland. Chairman Sir Victor Blank, who faced criticism for his role in the HBOS takeover, is set to retire from his post to placate angry shareholders. Yesterday, nationalised Northern Rock reported a £724 million loss. Royal Bank of Scotland announces its figures on Friday. At least four people are dead and 10 injured after a gunman opened fire in a gymnasium in the American city of Pittsburgh. The gunman said to be among the dead after taking his own life. The victims are believed to be women who were attending a Latin dance class. A policeman at the scene said he didn't say anything. He walked right into the room where the shootings occurred, as if he knew exactly where he was going. Bill Clinton's left North Korea after securing the release of two American reporters who'd been held in Pyongyang since March. North Korean leader Kim Jong-il issued a special pardon to the journalists after meeting the former US president on Tuesday. Laura Ling and Yuna Lee had been found guilty of entering North Korea illegally. There's more on this story to come later in Guardian Daily. People should travel by train rather than use domestic flights, according to the Transport Secretary, Lord Adonis. He's laid out his plans for high-speed rail links. In an interview, which you can hear later in the programme, he told The Guardian plans for a new generation of ultra-fast trains are well advanced. Last night, the British Air Transport Association, though, said the government would not be able to eliminate flights within the UK altogether. Now, for a look at today's papers, starting with The Telegraph, which looks into the expense claims of John Bercow, the new Speaker of the House of Commons. The paper claims he is having his Grace and Favour apartment refurbished to the tune of £20,000, all at taxpayers' expense. Tory grandee Lord Paton is vying to become EU Foreign Minister, in a move that would embarrass David Cameron, says the Financial Times. Meanwhile, Harriet Harman's using Gordon Brown's holiday to set her agenda, according to the Times. Harman's demanding a radical overhaul of Britain's rape laws. The Mail, however, believes she's behind an initiative to teach pupils as young as five about the evils of domestic violence. Trucking outrage is the headline in The Sun. It claims armoured trucks needed in Afghanistan are stuck in Dubai. The Mirror reports BBC newsreader George Alagaya has been forced to quit as patron of a charity over a conflict of interest in what the papers say is a case of double standards. The Express, meanwhile, claims eating oily fish helps cut the risk of heart disease. And the back pages focus on the sale of Liverpool's Xabi Alonso to Real Madrid for nearly £30 million. And Portsmouth players have allegedly been involved in a brawl at a hotel. That's according to the Mail. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Britain's Transport Secretary, Lord Adonis, wants to unite the country with a high-speed rail network.
Most countries in Europe now, and most major countries in Asia, have been building high-speed lines between their major cities. And it looks increasingly clear that we should be doing the same here in Britain. So we're getting a plan together by the end of this year for how we can start building a high-speed network that links our major conurbations, starting with London and the West Midlands, which are the two major conurbations. And then we need to take a view as to the rate at which we can build out, how we go north of the West Midlands to link the other conurbations up to Scotland, and the kind of technology that we use. It'll be 4 or 5 years before we've got a plan and all the necessary planning consents to start constructing a high-speed network. And we will then do it progressively over the next 10, 20, 30 years, build out the network. And of course, it has to be done at a rate at which it's affordable. But every other major country in Europe and Asia has found it affordable to build a new state-of-the-art high-speed rail network linking the major cities. And I see no reason why we can't do the same here in Britain, because we're going to have to invest in the next generation infrastructure for our transport system. The question is just what type of infrastructure it is. But if we have a credible plan in place over the next 4 or 5 years, there's no reason why you couldn't have your first part of your north-south high-speed rail line open within 10 to 15 years.
That was Lord Adonis. I asked The Guardian's transport correspondent, Dan Milmo, why such a network has suddenly become such a top priority.
It's partly to do with the political personality that is Lord Adonis. He describes himself as a change bringer. He did a lot with education in government, and now that he has the transport brief, he believes personally that high-speed rail can bring the country together, can actually cause social change. And that's one of the factors behind this that we shouldn't forget, that Lord Adonis himself knows Whitehall well, and he's just bringing heads together to get a high-speed rail network underway.
Now, that's very laudable. The question really is, he's already said that many other countries have already done this. Why is Britain so late to the table?
Well, there's a number of reasons going back many decades. The first one, which has been raised by a lot of transport experts that we've spoken to, is almost within the political culture. It's just not the way successive Labour and Conservative governments have approached transport spending, whereas in France, since the 70s, they've decided this is a public good, we're going to pump billions of francs and euros into it, no matter what. In Britain, there's just not been that sort of political culture, if you will. Secondly, we had the mess of rail privatisation from the late 90s and most of the last decade to clear up. That took time, ministerial time and government money to do. So during that period, high-speed rail was off the agenda. Now that the rail network's kind of stable, it seems like a natural point to consider what next. And when you think what next, well, perhaps building new lines is one of the better options.
Now, there's a green component to this as well. And one of the arguments being raised is this is an antidote to the many short-haul flights that Britons make. But couldn't it also be seen as the antidote to all of those car trips that might be unnecessary?
Yes, it certainly could. I mean, let's not forget that the majority mode of travel in the UK by passenger is car. More than 8 out of 10 passenger journeys are by car. So certainly you would expect the Department for Transport, and indeed Lord Adonis, will be looking at how they can, in the first phase of this, stop people travelling by car from London to Birmingham, which are two big industrial work centres. And I'm sure that is a popular mode of travel. So yes, you would hope that high-speed rail will focus on that. But given Lord Adonis's comments to us that, you know, he's targeting short-haul aviation, that nonetheless is his target because it is, per passenger, one of the least green modes of travel.
Okay, let's talk about the feasibility, both political and financial, at this time.
Well, the political feasibility seems a lot stronger just because it's words. The Tories back it. The Lib Dems back it. Indeed, the Tories and the Lib Dems got there first. I mean, Lord Adonis is bringing a lot to it now, but nonetheless, the Labour government is the last to this party. But it's quite easy to say, yes, we are committed to a national rail network, where I think that consensus might begin to unpick itself after the next election, and if we do have a Conservative government, is when they look at the scale of the damage and work to be done on the public finances. Lord Adonis said to us that the only way a high-speed rail network will go ahead and possibly be completed by 2020, sorry, the first phase of a high-speed network, is if it is a number one spending priority. What we're looking at, quite highly probably, is there won't be the money for a number one spending priority, and that is where the political consensus will just fall apart.
Dan Milmo.
Also on the website today, can supposed medical breakthroughs based on research done on mice really cure us humans? Alok Jha at guardian.co.uk/science. How Britain fell in love with Poundland. Just don't ask staff how much items cost. John Henley finds out at guardian.co.uk/money. And meet the face of flogging, the latest social networking craze in Argentina. For that one, go to guardianweekly.co.uk. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton has been sent to North Korea to secure the release of two U.S. journalists held since March. Tanya Branigan, The Guardian's Beijing correspondent, reports on this unusual diplomatic mission and discusses what it tells us about President Obama's strategy toward the nuclear defiance of Kim Jong-il.
Well, the White House is very keen to stress that this is a private mission, they say, an attempt to rescue the two American journalists who've been jailed there, sentenced to 12 years after they were arrested on the border with China. Now, and of course, in a sense, that sounds quite plausible. They worked for a television station which was co-founded by Al Gore, who, of course, was Clinton's vice president. But none of the analysts you speak to really believe that the husband of the Secretary of State is going all the way to North Korea without the tacit approval, at least, of the White House.
Is there any evidence that Pyongyang is immune to the Clinton charm, which seems to be worldwide potency?
Well, I think probably Pyongyang feels that Bill Clinton is somebody that they can do business with. The last time a former president of the US went to North Korea, in fact, the first time was President Carter, and that was at a point where the US under Bill Clinton was really bracing for a potential war with North Korea. But Carter flew in and he had a pretty successful visit, which led to a sort of breakthrough deal on North Korea's nuclear program. And then again, rather later in Clinton's presidency, Madeleine Albright actually went as Secretary of State. So there's a feeling that Clinton is somebody who has a track record of dealing with North Korea and, of course, being quite persuasive with people in general, which really doesn't do any harm. And some people had thought the fact he was married to Hillary Clinton might rule him out because it would just be seen as simply too sensitive for him to go. But obviously, from the North Korean point of view, that's a bit of a bonus, really, because they can say, you know, look, here's this guy, not only is he a former president, but he's tied in very intimately to the administration, and here he has come to talk to us.
There are a lot of people who say that the nuclear intransigence of North Korea is just a cry for help. They want attention, they want to be talked to, they really want to be a player in the world stage. To that extent, do you think this visit could help them?
Well, this is certainly about the nuclear program as much as it is about the journalists in the eye of pretty much everybody. I mean, it comes against a background, as you've pointed out, of rising tensions. They've conducted a nuclear test. They've talked about restarting their nuclear program. We think they've done that. They've launched a series of missiles. But as you say, a lot of analysts think that that is really directed at trying to get the US in particular to speak to them. They've said they want direct one-to-one talks with the US. They don't believe in the six-party talks, which also involve China, South Korea, Russia and so forth. And America has said, well, OK, we can have bilateral talks with you, but only on the sidelines of the Six Nation discussions. So North Korea is really very keen to kind of try and push America into speaking to them. And in fact, we know that Hillary Clinton only last week said, well, the North Koreans are like children who are seeking attention and we shouldn't sort of reward them for that because they don't deserve it. Some people are suggesting that Clinton's visit could be seen in that light. That's Bill Clinton's visit. That in a sense, the North Koreans will take this as encouragement and that they can go on perhaps ratcheting up tensions in the future. But the other way of looking at it, of course, is that people say, well, if we don't engage, surely they're just going to carry on with this series of missile launches and other acts, which certainly both Washington and Seoul see as being provocative.
Given how secretive the Pyongyang regime is, how will we know when this mission might bear fruit?
Well, it's rather hard to say, I suppose, in a sense, what bearing fruit might be. I mean, one thing is that there's obviously been a very high-level meeting. The North Korean state media are now reporting that Clinton has met with Kim Jong-il, who's the rather reclusive leader who hasn't been seen very much, certainly recently. And the state media are saying that they exchanged views on a wide range of opinions. And you can certainly imagine that the opinions of Bill Clinton and the US might be rather widely ranging from those of Kim Jong-il and the North Koreans. Where it will actually lead, we don't know. The feeling of several of the analysts I spoke to was that Clinton basically wouldn't have gone unless there was a pretty much a sort of reasonable agreement on the table. But we simply don't know at this stage. As you say, it's a very secretive regime, so we really need to wait and see what comes out over the next few days.
Tanya Branigan. For more on this story, go to guardian.co.uk/North Korea. Coming up, urban salvation for the honeybee. But first, the pensions deficit of the FTSE 100 companies has reached £100 billion. The Observer's business editor, Ruth Sunderland, surveys the damage and examines what can be done about it.
Well, it's very bad. It's the worst it's ever been. The collective deficit across all the blue chip companies in the index is nearly £100 billion. That's £100 billion. And that's more than double what it was a year ago when it was £41 billion. So that is pretty phenomenal as a number.
And what kind of strategy do these companies have to deal with this deficit?
Well, that's an extremely good question. In lots of cases, the strategy seems to be little more than crossing their fingers and hoping for things to improve. I would say that a lot of them don't have a realistic strategy because at the moment their cash resources are very stretched because of the credit crunch. And if they were to plug these pension gaps, it would cost them huge sums of money.
Now, some of these companies are resorting to bonds at a time when the market is going up. Can you explain why that is?
Well, part of the reason is that the proportion of their holdings in shares have gone down because until recently, the markets had gone down. So this equity rally is a relatively recent phenomenon. And the survey that we're looking at is to end of year. So at that stage, after Lehman Brothers collapsed, the stock markets actually fell back quite sharply. So as a result, purely of that, the amount in equities fell. Now, there has also been a move by companies to move away from shares and into less risky assets like bonds. Now, that's a long-term strategy, and that would not be determined by a rally of, you know, a few days or weeks or even months.
Okay. So what kind of prospects do people have, people who are working for one of these companies? What kind of pension hope do they have?
Well, anybody who is working in a private sector company, whether that's FTSE 100 company or not, is looking at a situation where the traditional final salary pension scheme is withering on the vine. There are fewer schemes available. There are only three left open to new members of these companies in the FTSE 100 index. And over the year, several have either closed down their schemes or actually even stopped existing members from getting more benefits. And what the big companies do, the smaller ones actually follow suit. So the upshot of all of that is that the credit crunch and the financial crisis have exacerbated the problems already facing pension funds. This means that each of us, if we're in the private sector, is going to have to take more responsibility for our own pension provision. And probably most of us could kiss goodbye to those dreams of early retirement because we are going to have to work harder for longer to be able to afford it.
Just keep grinding at it.
Keep at it.
Ruth Sunderland, thank you very much. In Totnes, three Tory hopefuls have competed for a spot on the next general election ballot. Stephen Morris reports on the results of the first ever postal primary balloting.
It's Ken Holmes.
And are you a member of the
Yes, I am.
Association?
I am.
So what do you think of this process?
Interesting. It's been a fairly long drawn out process. And some people obviously feel that the association has been diminished in some way and that we haven't been able to select our own candidate. But on the other hand, it's extension of democracy and openness after the problems we've had over expenses, etc., might be have to be a good thing.
And what do you think then?
What do I think?
Mm.
I must say, I would have preferred the association to pick our own candidate. And because I think it's thrown it to, we pick three people, any one of whom would make a reasonable member of parliament. It wouldn't be a disaster if any one of them was selected. But on the other hand, it might well be that members of the association would have preferred one of the three against others. But you know, now it's open to the whole constituency, members or not. It's also open to a degree of abuse, but I think, obviously, the powers that be in the party felt that it would be an opportunity to get a bit of good publicity and widening the franchise, and they took it. Whether it's going to be a good idea, I don't think we shall know until after the general election.
And until you see who's won today, well, I guess.
Yes. Well, we see who's won and see how the winner gets on next year, assuming the election is next year.
Nick By, 3,088. Sarah Randall Johnson, 5,495. And Sarah Wollaston, 7,914. Dr. Sarah Wollaston is therefore our successful candidate. I therefore declare that Sarah Wollaston has been selected as the prospective Conservative candidate for Totnes, and I need a show of hands, please, for the formal adoption of that. Absolutely overwhelming. Thank you, you're all free to go, and thank you very much.
I'm Dr. Sarah Wollaston.
And your title, your new title is?
Oh, I'm now the candidate, the prospective parliamentary candidate for Totnes.
Congratulations. How does that feel?
That's wonderful. Thank you.
How's the process been for you, a different sort of process?
It's, for myself personally, it's been an amazing journey. I've learnt a lot. I've met some wonderful people. And I'm really looking forward to taking it forward to the next stage now.
Well, I guess it's not only Conservative people who will have voted for you, it's Liberal Democrats, Labour people even. What do you think of that? Does it feel different?
I think the big difference is that it does give you a real responsibility to make sure that if you are eventually elected as an MP, that you're there to represent the whole constituency, and that my main priority should be a good constituency MP and look after the interests of Totnes, Brixham and South Hams.
And when does campaigning begin?
Well, very soon.
Britain's bees have been hard hit both by disease and by the destruction of their rural habitat. Hope for their revival may lie, oddly enough, in the city. I spoke to Johannes Paul, who helped create the Bee House, a way for urban dwellers to help save the humble bee.
The problem is obviously quite complex, as these things normally are, but stems from years and years of bees being kind of overworked and kept in just single areas of the sort of the countryside where the food that they foraged on was large areas of single type of crops. So they didn't get a continuous supply of food. They got sort of short, sharp bursts of feed. And then obviously they had to deal with pesticides as well. And unfortunately, a lot of those weren't actually safe for bees. And so large numbers sort of died out from pesticides and also just from having their natural habitat eroded. So The bee house, the new beehive that we've developed, is aimed at diversifying where people can keep bees, and that means primarily trying to bring the buzz back into urban environments and get people keeping bees.
So this is from Bauhaus to bee house.
That's right, yeah.
And tell me about the kind of urban beekeeper that you envisage.
Well, it's pretty much anyone who's got a garden or even a rooftop, because roofs make great spaces to keep bees, who has an interest in self-sufficiency, I guess, and growing their own, and because obviously the product that you get out of it is honey. And anyone who's decided that actually they'd like to do something about the fact that bees are struggling, and they can get involved by keeping bees, it's probably the best way.
So there's a green motive as well as a taste motive.
I mean, it's such a fantastic hobby. It's so interesting. I mean, it's, you know, beats watching TV, going to the cinema any day, and just spending an hour with your bees once a week is really, it's quite a privilege, because you get to actually see the inner workings of a bee colony.
Is there a calming effect?
Yeah, absolutely, because you need to, when you're working with the bees, remain calm. There's nothing that sort of annoys them more than somebody sort of crashing around in their house. So, above all, it's sort of calm, peaceful movements. And you sort of have to feel yourself going into a slightly different state of mind when you're around them.
That would be very good for us city folk.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Now, for those of us who may think this is too complicated, I won't know how to do it, give us a sense of what's involved.
Okay, so during the spring and summer is when the bees are most active. In the winter, they're hibernating, so you don't have to do anything then.
But during the spring and summer, you'll spend about an hour a week. And what you're really looking for is the rate that the queen is laying her eggs, and that will determine how fast the colony grows and how strong it is. And you're just checking that they've got enough honey stores, so that they've got the fuel that they need. And then pollen, which is the food, the protein that they eat, and what they feed their young. And then the final thing that you're checking for is that they're healthy. So just checking for the varroa mite, which is the big problem at the moment for bees. And then obviously acting on any of those things if there is a problem with any of those areas.
All right, so if our listeners are interested, where do they go?
The best place to check it out is on our website, which is omlet.co.uk, and everything's on there.
That's omlet, O-M-L-E-T.
That's correct, yeah.
All right, Johannes Paul, thank you very much. This podcast was produced by Adam Gabbett and Phil Maynard. I'm Jim Falzerano. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.